Hello, and welcome to Social Design Insights, the podcast that brings you the leading voices of the social design movement from the fields of architecture, engineering, planning, art, and whoever else we can find that's out there trying to make the world a better place. I'm your host, Eric Hessel. And we are back. It is 2019. I'm feeling good. Baruch just had a vacation. I'm in India working on a top secret project, but I will be back in the Bay Area shortly because my students need me. Or at least that's what I tell myself. At any rate, thanks to the good people at the Curry Stone Foundation, we've been renewed again. I guess that means you guys like the show. So, what's up for 2019? Well, we're going to be looking at a few new topics in the coming year. The nice thing about a show like this is that every amazing guest suggests three other amazing guests, and every topic we cover makes us excited to cover something else. Like last year, we're going to try and push the envelope, and we want to hear from you. What are the issues that concern you the most for the field of social design? What's bugging you? Here's what's bugging us. For the next 8 weeks, we're going to be looking at technology. Specifically, we're going to be looking at the intersection of technology, humanity, and design. I started thinking about this segment last year, and in a conversation with a colleague, I asked whether social designers were adopting BIM, building information modeling, in their designs. My colleague seemed unsure, as did the next colleague and the next. It seemed as if some were and some weren't, which is funny because the for-profit market design industry switched over completely about a decade ago. So I started thinking about how social designers adopt or don't adopt new technologies. We're living in a world increasingly defined by the latest app, by AI, by drones, automation, and 10 years hence, these technologies will completely upend the role of the conventional designer. What are they going to do for the social designer? What technologies now exist that could be leveraged for a better human future? I was discussing the issue a few months ago with Ken Banks, a social entrepreneur who won the Curry Stone Design Prize in 2011 for his work with Frontline SMS, a free open-source software used by a variety of organizations to distribute and collect information via text messages. The software was originally developed in 2005 for conservationists to keep in touch with communities in Kruger National Park in South Africa, and has since been adopted by numerous humanitarian and nonprofit groups. So I wanted to get him on the show and help me kick off this segment. And Ken isn't just here for his work with Frontline SMS. Ken is currently the head of social impact at Yoti. He's also an award-winning social entrepreneur, mobile technology and global development expert and author, a PopTech fellow, a Tech Awards laureate, an Ashoka fellow, and a National Geographic Emerging Explorer. In 2013, he was nominated for the TED Prize. In recognition of his pioneering work, he was presented with the 2017 Eugene Lawler Award for Humanitarian Contributions Within Computer Science by the Association of Computing Machinery in the USA, and most recently in 2018 was appointed a visiting fellow at the prestigious Judge Business School in Cambridge. I wanted Ken to come on the show and talk to us about technology in the humanitarian and social sectors. Ken has been working in IT since the birth of the field. Within his current position at Yoti, he's working on securing digital identity for the 1.1 billion people on Earth who can't prove who they are. Why is that so important? I'll let Ken explain it to you. Let's get to the interview. Ken, hello. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. It's great to have you here and great to speak again.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, it's been a while.
I confess, Ken, that I really wanted you in particular to help us kick off this segment just because of, you know, the depth of your background. And, you know, the segment is around the intersection between technology and design and humanitarianism. And that's really been your entire career. I mean, not your entire career. I realize you started with brief stints in commercial IT and finance and that sort of thing. Maybe you could take the audience back to those beginnings and tell us a little bit about, you know, how you came to do what you do. What were the major milestones in terms of going from, you know, a mild-mannered commercial IT person to, well, who you are today?
Well, I think as a young person, I always felt that there was a purpose in me being here. I think many people, young people I speak to and meet on my travels are the same. There's that niggling question in the back of your mind, like what am I supposed to be doing here, and what's my purpose, and what should I spend my time on, and what's going to keep me happy for the rest of my life in terms of a career and a job and something that's going to occupy, you know, most of my time. And that was always at the back of my mind, even, you know, throughout the early days of working in finance and working in IT and doing pretty boring, ordinary types of jobs. You know, I saw Live Aid in 1985, the rock concert that Bob Geldof organized that played around the world in support of the Ethiopian famine relief. And it kind of got me thinking that, you know, the world's a big place. I was living on this little island in Jersey, pretty comfortable existence. There were people out there who were suffering and starving and dying purely because they were there and I wasn't there. I mean, there was no other reason that, you know, I just happened to be born in a nicer part of the world. So, you know, I just got off on this journey, really, where I just set out to understand the world. And at that point, the only real skills I had were technology skills. So I started out trying to figure out, how does somebody who knows technology work in humanitarian work?
And what was your initial foray into the humanitarian space, and what did that look like?
Well, you know, I realized that I had a lot to learn, and I actually knew nothing. And, you know, sometimes it's a good place to start if you're honest about where you're starting.
I think that every person who does humanitarian work puts their toes in the pool, and they have that one experience that says, okay, yeah, right, this is what I'm supposed to be doing for the rest of my life. Did you have one of those moments?
I think I did, yeah. I, you know, went to Zambia in 93, helped build a school, and thought to myself, you know, this is it's a whole new world out there. There's a whole new way of living for people. There's levels of suffering that I never imagined possible. There were incredibly talented people who were suffering purely because they were born in a place where opportunity really didn't really count for much at all. So I think it was just over a period of time, over that trip in Zambia, over a trip in Uganda 2 years later to help build a hospital, that I realized that this is the thing that I needed to be doing. The only problem I had at that point in my career was that, of course, in the mid-90s, there weren't mobile phones all over the place. There wasn't really the internet to speak of. So, you know, somebody with a passion for making a difference in the world who knew technology, I was probably 5 years too early at that point in time to be able to do anything. So those were the years that really drove me to deciding I'm going to quit this materialistic lifestyle that I'm on a course to kind of be experiencing going through. And I want to commit my life now to solving these humanitarian problems. But the world wasn't quite ready for me at that point.
I love that visual. The world was not ready for me, but it eventually was, wasn't it? I mean, we did give rise to the internet and mobile phones and this sort of thing. And you use those as platforms to do humanitarian action. One of the reasons that I wanted to do this segment, Ken, and talk to you specifically, is because, you know, I've observed through my own career that in a lot of these humanitarian efforts, the technology is sometimes 5 years, 10 years, 20 years behind what might be considered normal in the private or commercial sectors. Why is that? Why? I mean, in your own case, because you started in a technological field before you started in a humanitarian field, before the field of IT and internet and all these things really existed, I mean, your path seems relatively organic. For a lot of these organizations, I mean, it seems like they're a bit stunted in terms of adopting new technologies. What are the resource constraints? Why don't we see the sort of progressive technological intent in the humanitarian sector that we might see in, say, the private sector?
Yeah, it's a great question. I suppose to sum it in one sentence, probably the vast majority of technologies that we experience have only been built for the top 5% of the planet. The other 95% are the ones who are either in places where the markets are too difficult to crack, or they're not wealthy enough to be able to afford the technology, or there might be other factors which might stop the tech going in there. It might be inappropriate, it might be culturally inappropriate, it may be the level of knowledge about technology is too low, and so on. So when you think about Apple products, a very, very successful company, obviously, but there are still far more Android phones out there than there are Apple devices, for example. Apple are relatively unique in the sense that they're going for those higher spenders, higher earners, and so on. At least they were in the beginning. And I think this has sort of copied itself out into the humanitarian sector, really, that most technologies that people have been building are for the early adopters. They're for those where the market opportunities are easiest. All the other places get left behind because they're harder to crack. And I still meet many people who look at Africa as a market opportunity, but they have absolutely no idea where to start. They're either scared of going into Africa because of all misconceptions of the corruption and the brutality and the civil wars, or they think, my goodness, only 40% of Africans have got the internet, and how on earth do we do anything without the internet? And even more don't have smartphones yet, and they're still relying on voice calls and text messages. So the environment's just incredibly different because of those earlier factors. So I think it almost becomes a circle on itself that people don't go there because it's tricky. And because it's tricky, they just stay kind of in the past in a way. But that said, actually, a lot of the solutions we see there are pretty exciting and unique and innovative on their own account. They're not, when you compare them to maybe stuff going on in the UK or the US, but in their own terms, they're doing some pretty incredible stuff.
Tell us about some of that stuff.
Well, I think a great one is mobile banking. Kenya is the world leader in mobile banking. Sometimes when I speak at conferences about that, it's sort of you feel the oxygen leaving the room because people assume, well, it's got to be the US or Europe, surely. But you know, for the last 12 or so years, Kenyans have been transferring money around their mobile networks via SMS and other methods long before anybody in the UK or the US was doing it. And I remember joking with people that, you know, in Nairobi, I could jump in a cab and pay with my phone, yet I couldn't do that when I got back to London. The reasons that they do these things, the reasons that that happened are, you know, to do with the different market opportunities. The fact that it used SMS and USSD, the strange combination of keystrokes that you make on a phone, was because there weren't apps, because there weren't banks on every corner, because it was hard to get money around. So it was innovation out of necessity and innovation out of constraints that led them to those solutions. And there were no alternatives. If somebody hadn't done that, nobody else was going to go and build anything which did the same thing. And so it's that drive for innovation that I find fascinating. It's like, you know, if we don't do this, nobody else is.
I think you hear about in, you know, any introductory social entrepreneurship class about the mobile systems in Africa, you know, and the fact that, you know, the continent, there was this question of like, okay, how do we deploy telecommunications? And everybody started, you know, thinking about it in terms of first world systems, right? You know, how do we build power plants and relay stations and everything like that? And Africa managed to essentially leapfrog that into the mobile revolution and get connected that way. So skip over 50, 75 years of development that had happened in the UK and the US and that sort of thing. What's the next iteration of that? I mean, you spoke about opportunities and innovation out of necessity. What do you see as the next innovation coming out of Africa?
You know, when you think about mobile technology and communications, it's all about moving bits and bytes and sound waves around a country or around a continent. And that, as you say, they leapfrog landline infrastructure and many of the things that we had because they adopted it so late that actually there was never an opportunity to do that. And where landlines were introduced, they were very poorly maintained and never really worked. I think the next thing we're going to see, though, is we're going to go from bits and bytes to atoms. We're going to start seeing drone technologies delivering medical equipment or medical aid or blood, drone deliveries and so on, which again is something which is sort of kind of taking off a little bit in the developed world. But we have lots of alternatives. Again, it goes back to that point that there's not really many ways you can do these things in these markets. If you take many African countries, you know, the roads are very poor, the infrastructure is very poor. It takes a very long time to get anything shipped anywhere. So if you look at a drone, that's a great way of getting from A to B if the payload's not too heavy. You know, now we're seeing Zipline and other companies in African countries, Rwanda and so on, who are delivering blood supplies and medicine via a network of drones. So I think the next big leapfrogging innovation is going to be ways in which African countries use technology to move physical objects, not just bits and bytes.
That's interesting how you put that because, you know, the uptake to certain technologies in first world developed Western countries at times seems cultural, you know, like self-driving cars. You know, I read these articles about how, you know, one got in an accident, so we're going to shut down the entire program, despite the fact that, you know, 50,000 humans get in accidents every year. You know, the safety record for remote controlled cars just seems to be so much better than the human alternative. And yet there's something cultural that sort of prevents us from doing that. And as you said, we have a ton of alternatives. So we can set that technology aside and allow it to, you know, slug along essentially for years and years before we adopt it. I hear what you're saying as, you know, in areas of great necessity, those technologies may actually come to fruition faster than they would in their Western counterparts because they're more necessary and there's a lack of alternatives.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the cultural stuff is an element that's always interested me. You know, my degree is anthropology. I come at a lot of the technology work that not only I've done, but the work that I see and the organizations that I've consulted with from an anthropological viewpoint. So, you know, we need to remember that at the end of the day, it's always going to be a person interacting with or using a technology that we build in most cases, unless you're doing some kind of strange machine learning type projects where there might not be people involved. But for most people working in the humanitarian sector, You know, the word human is in there, right? There's a person involved. So understanding their context is absolutely key. Understanding the geography of where they live and the economics of their lives and gender issues and all those other things, which a lot of technology projects and a lot of techies tend to ignore, I think are the more fascinating bit for me. With my messaging platform, when we talk about, you know, simple technologies, I became very well known for deploying SMS systems around African countries, or at least providing a platform that allowed people to use text messaging. And text messaging, every year people were writing it off as an old, boring technology, but it was the only thing that worked and the only thing that was particularly relevant for the audience that I knew needed help. But thinking about the context of those users, understanding that they don't have the internet, understanding they don't have smartphones, understanding that they don't have access to landlines, they don't have access to libraries, the only way they're going to get information is going to be through their phone. Understanding the gender dynamics of owning a phone. You know, in many communities, women aren't allowed to own phones. So there's issues there. If you're developing a product for women and you think women are just going to download this thing and use it, that can be pretty tricky in places where women are barred from using phones. The fact that phones are shared in some communities, you know, how do you develop a product which there may be an element of people sharing private data? How do you do that in a context where that phone then gets passed from brother to sister, to father, to mother, to grandmother? All those things I found really interesting. And so many projects failed because they didn't understand those anthropological human dynamics around how technology was used in those places, because it was very, very different to where the people who were building the technology came from.
You're listening to Social Design Insights. We hope you're enjoying these thoughts from Ken Banks of Yodi about his path, unifying technology and humanitarian intent, and what designers potentially get wrong about how to utilize technology. When we get back, we're going to be talking about his current endeavor and the plight of the 1.1 billion people on Earth who don't actually have an ability to prove their identity. And Ken is going to give us a window into future applications of technology in the social world. We're going to try and dream big. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back with more Social Design Insights after the break. Welcome back to Social Design Insights. We've been speaking with Ken Banks of Yodi about applications of technology in social design. Coming up, we're going to get right down to it, and we're going to talk about how bright the future is. Let's rejoin the conversation. You know, in planning this segment, I thought the issue isn't technology, it's humanity, right? And we can sit in a lab and invent things all day long, but unless you have the human context behind you when you're going through that innovation exercise, what you invent usually just ends up on the scrap heap. Would a better question be, like, how do we position ourselves in a humanitarian space in a human context and use that as a platform for technology rather than, hey, why don't designers adopt technology?
Yeah, that could be one of them. I think there may be others. One that I tend to use when I speak to students and go to conferences, that, you know, you really need to start with the problem. Let's not worry about technologies. Let's not worry about how we're going to implement technologies. Let's not think about what our favorite technologies are. Let's not even think about where funding is going to support projects that use technologies. Because, you know, many people develop solutions around technologies because they happen to be hip and trendy and everyone's talking about them. Blockchain's a great example. You know, the blockchain's going to solve everything if you listen to people who work with blockchain. You know, an analogy I like to use is that in some cases, the answer might be a blackboard to the problem you're looking to solve. But if you go at it trying to make it a smartphone, then A, you're going to build something which is not particularly relevant, and B, you're going to build something which just doesn't work for the people that you're trying to help. So for me, it is really all about understanding the problem first before you even start to think about what technology you might use, how you might go about building that technology and testing that technology, how you might go about thinking about the user interface between the technology and the people you're trying to help, what their literacy skills or what their technical literacy skills might be. So that's how I've always encouraged people to start. And very often you find that in most cases, if people don't start by really understanding the problem, the project ends in failure. And the only way I felt to understand the problem was to spend time in the field living with and spending a lot of time with the people I sought to help.
Ken, getting back to what you said, it reminded me of something my father used to say. He used to tell me that to a man with a hammer in his hand, everything looks like a nail.
Yeah.
And I wonder sometimes whether the problem is that designers want to design. They think that the answer to everything is a design, and you can't quell that instinct to sit down and just design something around this problem. As you eloquently state, sometimes the solution is just a blackboard, you know, or something even more simple. How do we rethink the very process of design? We start with the problem. Is this a cultural revolution that we're asking architects and engineers and product designers to go through so that they realize that the answer isn't always a design?
It's a great question. I think there's a couple of things in there. I mean, first of all, design is part of the solution. So, you know, once you've identified a problem and you've established that it is actually a problem that is worth solving, then you sort of start moving to the realms of the mechanics of it. And the mechanics would be, what's the best technology choice based on what these people have? Can they charge this device? Can they use it? Does it come in a language they will understand? Can they afford to buy it if they need to buy it? Once you've gone through all of that, then design comes in for me, because it's at that stage that you need to start thinking about how are these people going to interact with the solution you develop through this device or through this thing. But if anything, the problem we have is that maybe design comes up a little bit too early and people dive into the design before they've thought about the problem and the mechanics of what it is that they're trying to solve.
Reminds me of something else my father used to say about putting the cart before the horse. You two would have gotten along.
I'll take that as a compliment.
You should, yes. You should. He was a good guy. Ken, you became very well known for Frontline SMS and in fact won the Curie Stone Design Prize for that work, but have gone on to do many things at the intersection of humanity and technology. And your latest venture is as head of social impact at Yoti. Let's start with the basics. What is a Yoti?
So Yoti is a London-based company who have built a digital identity solution. So, you know, we all know that you can have your identity stolen online. People's lives sometimes get destroyed by having their identity stolen, and people apply for loans and do all sorts of other things in their name. When you go onto a site and you see all of the crazy comments and the trolling and the abuse, you know, and all the bots flying around and so on, that being online is kind of messy. In the Yoti world, we allow you to verify yourself as being a unique, real individual online, and to prove you are that each time you interact with the service, and to select which bits of that identity that you share. So, for example, if you signed into Facebook using your Yoti, then Facebook would know that you were actually that person, because it's based on your biometrics and also the scanning of passports and driving licenses and other documents that you might possess. Right now, I think everybody listening to this show knows how easy it is to sign into Facebook, make up a name, upload anyone's picture, and just start trolling away. And if you get blocked because you're being particularly abusive, you just create a new email address somewhere and you do it again. You know, the online world is full of this. And one of the things that Yoti can help solve is by everyone having a unique digital identity, which they use to log in to these kinds of platforms, WhatsApp, Twitter, Facebook, and so on. You stop non-humans from getting into the systems, and you stop people signing in multiple times, because you've only got one face, right? So the system would know that you are the same person, even if you did try to change your name.
And how does this cross over into the humanitarian sector? Why is this a concern to the bottom billion?
There's about 1.1 billion people, funnily enough. You mentioned a billion. It's pretty much a billion. About a billion people on the planet who have no way of proving who they are.
Wow.
And so this becomes a problem. We all know if we want to get a mobile phone or whatever, we go to a store and we have to present a driving license or our social security number and maybe a utility bill from the last few months to show you live at a certain address. And there's a certain number of hoops you have to jump through before you can walk out with that phone. If you had no way of proving who you were, that would be impossible. Now, with a phone, that might not be a total game changer. But if you're a citizen in a developing country, and the only way you can access prenatal or postnatal healthcare, or get your children into school, or access government-funded programs to help you with work or so on, is by having an identity, being able to prove who you are. If you can't do that, that can actually have pretty serious implications on your life. And there are, as I say, about a billion, just over a billion people on the planet today who are lacking access to health services and education and other government services because they weren't given a birth certificate, or they have no way of saying, look, I am me. And in some cases, you meet people who don't know when they were born. They don't know their age. So there's a whole bunch of problems which having an identity can solve. The Yoti approach is that if we're going to be issuing identities to people now, then we can leapfrog the paper-based identities. And if people do have smartphones and technologies, how do we use those technologies to allow them to carry their identities around with them? So if you're migrants or you're fleeing conflict or so on, if your phone becomes your base identity, you can prove who you are when you enter a port of arrival or if you have to access a service and so on. It's a big problem.
No, it sounds like it. And I'm glad we spoke on it because I think it's a problem that not a lot of people know about. You know, when we were in touch a couple of months ago, you know, I was doing my homework and started thinking about it. Like, yeah, like if you can't prove who you are, that rules out voting, that rules out getting a loan, that rules out crossing a border, getting your kids into school, all sorts of things. Hopefully, our listeners will be shocked in a good way to hear about how big that problem is. Speaking of big problems, what keeps you going, Ken? What does the future look like in your eyes?
What keeps me going, I suppose, is a combination of guilt is a big part of it, which I'm not afraid to say. I just feel incredibly guilty that I am blessed to have been born in a developed country and have had the opportunities I've had. And I could have been born anywhere. And if I had been born somewhere else, I would probably have not had half the opportunities I've had. So I feel pretty guilty about that. And that guilt and sense of injustice drives me, because I don't think that will ever fully solve that. But also having young children now, I have, you know, 5-year-old twins and a 7-year-old. I had children quite late in my life because I spent so much time charging around the African continent trying to understand all the problems out there. But, you know, I see my children now and I think more and more about the world that I want them to live in, about how I want them to see the world, to drive curiosity and learning and compassion and empathy for others. But also just seeing other children. When I see pictures of fathers fleeing Syria, carrying their children from conflict, getting on these boats, not knowing if they're going to get across the Mediterranean, the things they are going through in order to keep their families safe, and seeing those kids and just thinking to myself, those could be my kids.
Yeah.
I find that incredibly hard to deal with. And I've spoken about that as well at various events. So it's those things that drive me. And I don't think anything will probably stop that. If anything, I probably have a little bit of empathy overdrive. I spend too much time thinking about other people's plight and how I might be able to do something to help them.
Ken, on this show, there's no such thing as empathy overdrive. You're very much at home and very welcome.
Well, thank you.
Ken, I think all of our listeners could benefit from reading your books, and we'll link to them on our website. Could you give us a quick preview?
Sure. So a couple of books I've written are about social innovation and social entrepreneurship. They're sort of books around serendipity, really. They're books about people who were reluctant, unexpected innovators in the fields that they became well known for. So these were people who encountered problems in the world they weren't expecting to encounter, and that they were troubled so much by them that they ended up devoting their lives to solving the problems that they came across. And I think the lesson that the book gives, and I think this is why it's particularly valuable to younger people who are trying to find their way perhaps, is that it shows you that the answers are out there, as are the problems, but you're only going to find them if you get yourself out there. You're not going to find the thing that you need to dedicate your life to and the thing that's going to get you up every morning by sitting in a classroom or by sitting in an office. But you need to go out, understand the world, and eventually a problem out there with your name on it will find you. And the books are about people that happened to. And I find that quite inspiring, because these people didn't study or have any intention of doing what they did. They just accidentally ended up solving significant problems in pretty amazing ways.
Amen to that. And thank you so much for joining us on the show. I think this was the perfect conversation to start a wider conversation about technology and design and humanity in a sort of gloves off sort of way. I don't want to romanticize the subject of technology or the subject of humanity. And I don't ever want to believe, and I don't think any of our listeners should believe, that technology is some sort of panacea that's going to rescue us from all of our human problems. It's a tool in a toolbox. And I think your career and your work offer good lessons about how to deploy it well.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed talking to you. Thank you.
You've been listening to Social Design Insights with Eric Kessel. I'd like to thank my guest of the week, Ken Banks of Yoti, for all of his wisdom about the role technology can play in the humanitarian and social design fields. To learn more about Ken and his work, please visit our website at curriestonefoundation.org. If you have any feedback on the show, ideas for guests, or just want to chat, you can write to me at eric@socialdesigninsights. That's eric@socialdesigninsights.com. Social Design Insights is produced by Baruch Zeichner. And at the break, we are listening to Mfaze Omdala by Juluka off their 1982 album, Ubule Benvelo. And that has now just been added to my cardio mix. Social Design Insights is an initiative of the Curry Stone Foundation. And believe it or not, we now have our own social media accounts, and we try to make every effort to use them appropriately. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. We have a really complicated handle. It's @SocialDesignInsights. I mean, for Facebook and Instagram. It's SocialDesignIN on Twitter. Our Tinder handle is secret, but email me and I'll give it to you. Check us out for all the latest news in social impact design.